Chapter 4. It's often remarked that diplomacy is just warfare by other means. Our battles are no less desperate for being bloodless, but at least we get wine and finger food. Tollan Furlang, Imperial Envoy to the Realm of Ultramar, 564 to 603, M41. "Are you sure you're fit enough?" Castine asked, a faint frown of concern appearing between her eyebrows. I nodded and adjusted the sling I'd adopted for dramatic effect. It was black silk, matching the ebony hues of my dress uniform, and made me look tolerably dashing, I thought. "I'm fine," I said, smiling bravely. "The other fellows got the worst of it, thank the Emperor. In the day or two since the brawl with the heretics, my arm had more or less healed. The medicae assuring me that I'd suffered nothing worse than severe bruising. It was still stiff and ached a little, but all in all, I thought I'd come off lightly. Far better than Devas had, anyway. He'd spent the night in the infirmary and still walked with a stick. For all that, though, he was as irritatingly cheerful as ever, and I'd been finding as many duties as I could to keep me out of the way whenever he suggested socialising again. Luckily for me, he'd lost consciousness before the Kroot turned up, so my reputation had received another unmerited embellishment. He assumed I'd seen off our assailant single-handed, and I saw no good reason to disabuse him. Besides, the conversation I'd had with the creature had been curiously unsettling, and I found myself reluctant to think about it too hard. I noticed Devas's account had tactfully glossed over the reason why we were in the thick of the Tau sympathizers' heartland, so maybe they'd finally knocked a little common sense into him. Knowing Devas, though, I doubted it. "Well, that's what they get for picking on the Imperium's finest," Castine said, eager to buy the generally accepted version of events, as the latest evidence of my exceptional martial abilities reflected well on the regiment she led. She adjusted her own dress uniform, tugging the ochre greatcoat into place with every sign of discomfort. Like most Valhallans, she had an ice-worlder's tolerance for cold, and found even the mildest of temperate climates a little uncomfortable. Having spent most of my service with Valhallan regiments, I'd long become inured to their habit of air-conditioning their quarters to temperatures which left the breath smoking, and tended to wear my commissarial greatcoat at all times, but they were still adjusting to the local conditions here with some difficulty. "If I might suggest, Colonel," I said, "tropical order would be perfectly acceptable." "Would it?" She hovered indecisively, reminding me again how young she was to be in such an elevated position, and I felt an unaccustomed pang of sympathy. The prestige of the regiment was in her hands, and it was easy to forget how heavily the responsibility weighed on her. "It would," I assured her. She discarded the heavy fur cap, disordering her hair, and began to unfasten the coat. And she hesitated. "I don't know," she said. "If they think I'm too informal, it'll reflect badly on all of us." "For the Emperor's sake, Regina," Brocklaw said, his voice amused. "What sort of impression do you think you'll make if you're sweating like an orc all evening?" I noted his use of her given name, the first time I'd heard him do so, with quiet satisfaction. Another milestone on the 597th's march towards full integration. The real test would come with their first taste of combat, of course, and all too soon at that, but it was a good omen. "The Commissar's right." "The Commissar's always right," I said, smiling. "It says so in the regulations." "Well, I can't argue with that." Castine pulled off the coat with evident relief and smoothed the jacket beneath it. It was severely cut, emphasizing her figure in ways that I was sure would attract the attention of most of the men in the room. Brocklaw nodded approvingly. "I don't think you need to worry about making an impression," he said, proffering a comb. "So long as it's a good one." She smoothed her hair into place and began buckling her weapon belt. Like mine, it held a chainsword, but hers was ornately gilded and worked with devotional scenes that decorated scabbard and hilt alike. The contrast with my own functional model, chipped and battered with far too much use for my liking, was striking. The holster at her other hip was immaculate too, The glossy black leather holding a bolt pistol, which also gleamed from every highly polished surface, and which was intricately engraved with icons of the saints. "No doubt about that," I assured her. Her nervousness was quite understandable, as we'd been invited to a diplomatic reception at the governor's palace. At least I had, and in the interests of protocol, the colonel of my regiment and an appropriate honour guard would also be expected. This sort of soiree was quite beyond her experience, and she was all too acutely aware that she was out of her depth. I, on the other hand, was well within mine. One of the many benefits of being a hero of the Imperium is that you're regarded as a prime catch by a certain type of society hostess, which meant I'd had plenty of opportunity to enjoy the homes, wine cellars and daughters of the idle rich over the years and had developed an easy familiarity with the world in which they moved. The main thing to remember, as I confided to Castine, was that they had their own idea of what soldiers were like, which had very little to do with the reality. "The best thing you can do," I said, "is not to get sucked into all that protocol nonsense in the first place. They'll expect us to get it wrong anyway, so to the warp with them." She smiled in spite of herself and settled a little more comfortably into the upholstery of the staff car Jürgen had found somewhere. Armed with my commissarial authority, which let him requisition practically anything short of a battleship without argument, he'd developed quite a talent for acquiring anything I considered necessary for my comfort or convenience over the years. I never asked too many questions about where they'd come from, as I suspected some of the answers might have complicated my life. "That's easy for you to say," she said. "You're a hero. I'm just one of the youngest regimental commanders in the entire guard," I said. "A position that, in my opinion, you hold entirely on merit." I smiled. "And my confidence is not lightly earned." It was what she needed to hear, of course. I've always been good at manipulating people. That's one of the reasons I'm so good at my job. She began to look a little happier. "So what do you suggest?" she said. I shrugged. "They might be rich and powerful, but they're only civilians. However hard they try to hide it, they'll be in awe of you. I've always found it best at these things just to be a plain, simple military man with no interest in politics. The Emperor points and we obey, through the warp and far away." She finished the old songline with a smile. "So we shouldn't offer any opinions or answer questions about policy?" "Exactly," I said. "If they want to talk, tell them a few stories about your old campaigns. That's all they're interested in anyway." That was certainly true in my case. I was sure I'd only been invited as patriotic window dressing to impress the Tau with the calibre of the opposition they'd be facing if they were foolish enough to try and make a fight of it with us. Of course, in my case, that meant they could pretty much run their flag up the pole of the governor's palace any time they felt like it. But that was beside the point. "Thank you, Caiaphas." Castine put her chin on her hand and watched the streetlights flicker past outside the window. That was the first time anyone in the regiment had addressed me in personal terms since I joined it. It felt strange, but curiously pleasant. "You're welcome, Regina," I said, and she smiled. "I know what you're thinking, and you're wrong. I did come to think of her as a friend in the end, and Brocklaw too, but that's as far as it went. Anything else would have made both our positions untenable. Sometimes, looking back, I think that's a shame, but there it is." The governor's palace was in what the locals called the Old Quarter, where the fad for Tau-influenced architecture, which had infected the rest of the city, had failed to take hold. So the vague sense of unease which had oppressed me since we arrived began to lift at last. The villas and mansions slipping past outside the car had taken on the familiar blocky contours of the imperial architecture with which I'd been familiar all my life, and I felt my spirits begin to rise to the point where I almost began to anticipate enjoying the evening ahead of us. Jürgen swung the vehicle through an elaborate pair of wrought iron gates decorated with the imperial aquila, and our tyres hissed over raked gravel as we progressed down a long, curving drive lit by flickering flambeaux. Behind us, the truck with our honour guard followed, no doubt making a terrible mess of things with its heavy-duty tyres. the soldiers making the most of the grandstand view afforded by its open rear decking to point and chatter at the sights. Beyond the flickering firelight, we could make out a rolling landscaped lawn, dotted with shrubs and ornamental fountains. Automatically, some part of my mind was assessing the best way of using them for cover. An audible gasp from Castine signalled that the palace itself had come into view from her side window, and a moment later, the curve of the drive brought it into my field of vision. "Not a bad little billet," I said with elaborate casualness. Castine composed herself, wiping the bumpkin gawp off her face. "Reminds me of a bordello we used to visit when I was an officer cadet," she replied, determined to match my blasé exterior. I grinned. "Good," I said. "Remember, we're soldiers. We're not impressed by this sort of thing." "Absolutely not," she agreed, straightening her jacket unnecessarily. There was a lot of the building not to be impressed by. It must have covered over a kilometre from end to end, although, of course, much of that area would be given over to courtyards and interior gardens currently hidden behind the outer wall. Buttresses and crenellations protruded like acne from every surface, encrusted with statuary commemorating previous governors and other local notables no one could now remember the names of, and vast areas had been gilded, reflecting the firelight from outside in a manner which was to prove eerily prophetic had we but known. At the time, though, it simply struck me as one of the most stridently vulgar piles of masonry I'd ever encountered. Jürgen pulled up outside the main entrance, halting at the end of a red carpet as skillfully as a shuttle pilot entering a docking port. After a moment, the truck pulled up behind us and our honour guard piled out, deploying on either side of it a full squad, five pairs of troopers facing each other across the crimson weave, lasguns at the port. "Shall we?" I extended an arm to Castine as a flunky dressed as a wedding cake bustled up to open the door for us. "Thank you, Commissar." She took it as we emerged, and I stopped for a moment to have a word with Jürgen. "Any further orders, sir?" I shook my head. "Just find somewhere to park and get yourself something to eat," I said. Strictly speaking, I could have had my aide accompany us, but the thought of Jürgen mingling with the cream of the Gravelaxian aristocracy was almost too hideous to contemplate. I turned to the noncom in charge of the honour guard, a Sergeant Lustig, and tapped the comm bead I'd slipped into my ear. "You too," I added. "You might as well be comfortable while you wait for us. I'll contact you when we're ready to leave." "Yes, sir." A faint smile tried to form on his broad face before discipline reasserted itself, and he inhaled.
"Squad! Attention!"
he bellowed, and they snapped to it with nanosecond precision. No surprise that they'd won the extra drink ration this week, I thought. The crash of synchronized heels caused heads to turn all around us, minor local nobles looking mightily impressed, and their chauffeurs even more so. "I think we've made an impression," Castine murmured as we gained the elaborately carved entrance doors. "That was the idea," I agreed. Inside, it was exactly as I'd anticipated, the kind of vulgar ostentation too many of the wealthy mistake for good taste, with crystal and gilt and garish tapestries of historic battles and smug-looking primarchs strewn around the place like a pirate's warehouse. The high-arched ceiling was supported by pillars, artfully carved to mimic the bark of some species of local tree, and my feet sank into the carpet as though it were a swamp. It took me a moment to realise that the weave would form a vast portrait, presumably of the governor himself, if viewed from the upper landing, and I noted with faint amusement that someone had trodden on a dropped canapé, making it look as though his nose was running. Whether it was a genuine accident or the act of a disgruntled servant, who could say? Castine's lips quirked as she absorbed the full opulence of our surroundings. "I take it back," she said quietly. "A bordello would have been done out in far better taste." I suppressed a smile of my own as another flunky ushered us forward.
"Commissar Caiaphas Kane," he announced, "and Colonel Regina Castine,"
which at least established who we were. It was pretty obvious who the unhealthy-looking individual sitting on a raised dais at the end of the room was. I'd met a few good planetary governors in my day, and they all tend towards inbred imbecility, but this specimen looked like he should take the prize.
Like many of Kane's sweeping generalizations, this does contain an element of truth. The majority of planetary governorships are hereditary positions, and many of the incumbents aren't up to the challenge of the job. However, the truly incompetent tend to be weeded out by the ceaseless round of dynastic power struggles and coup d'etat, which keep the aristocracy amused. And in cases where imperial interests are directly threatened, we can always turn to the officio assassinorum.
He somehow contrived to look both undernourished and flabby at the same time, and his skin was the pallor of a dead fish. Watery eyes of no particular colour goggled at us from under a fringe of thinning grey hair. "Governor Grice," I said, bowing formally. "A pleasure."
"On the contrary," he said, his voice quivering a little. "The pleasure's entirely mine."
Well, he wasn't wrong on that account, but he was ignoring me entirely. He stood and bowed to Castine.
"You honour us all with your presence, Colonel."
Well, that was a new experience. Being ignored in favour of a slip of a girl. But I suppose if you'd ever met her, you'd understand it. She was pretty striking, if redheads were your thing. And I suppose the old fool didn't get out much. Anyway, it enabled me to fade out of the picture and go looking for some amusement of my own, which I did with all due dispatch. As was my habit, I circulated widely, keeping my eyes and ears open, as you never know what useful little snippets of information will come in handy. Although the main thing that caught my attention was the entertainment. A young woman was standing on a podium at the end of the room, surrounded by musicians who sounded almost as well rehearsed as our regimental band, but they could have been playing orc war drums for all I cared, because her voice was extraordinary. She was singing old sentimental favourites like The Night Before You Left and The Love We Share, and even an old cynic like me could appreciate the emotion she put into them and feel that just this once the trite words were ringing true. Snatches of her husky contralto carried through the room wherever I was, cutting through the backbiting and the small talk, and I felt my eyes drifting in her direction every time the crowd parted enough to afford me a view. And the view was well worth it. She was tall and slim, with shoulder-length hair of a shade of blonde I've never seen on anyone else before or since, hanging loose to frame a face which nearly stopped my heart. Her eyes were the hazy blue of a far horizon and seemed to transfix me whenever I looked in her direction. Her dress was the same colour, almost exactly, and clung to her figure like mist. Now, I've never believed in sentimental nonsense like love at first sight, but I can say without a word of a lie that even now, after almost a century, I can close my eyes and picture her as she was then and hear those songs as though she's still in the same room. But I wasn't there to listen to cabaret singers, however enchanting. So I tried my best to mingle and pick up whatever gossip I could that would help us fight the tower if we had to, and keep me out of it, if at all possible. "So you're the famous Commissar Kane," someone said, passing me a fresh drink. I took it automatically, turning a little to use my right hand and emphasise the sling, and found myself looking at a narrow-faced fellow in an expensive but understated robe which positively screamed diplomat. He glanced at the sling. "I hear you nearly started the war early." "Not from choice, I can assure you," I said, "just defending an officer who lacked the self-restraint to ignore a blatant piece of sedition." "I see." He eyed me narrowly, trying to size me up. I kept my expression neutral. "I take it your self-restraint is a little stronger." "At the moment," I said, choosing my words with care, "we're still at peace with the Tau. The internal situation here is, I'll admit, a little disturbing. But unless the Guard is ordered to intervene, that's purely a matter for the Arbites, the PDF, and His Excellency." I nodded at Grice, who was listening to Castine explain the best way of disemboweling a termagant with every sign of interest, although his retinue of sycophants was beginning to look a little green around the gills. "I'm not averse to fighting if I have to, but that's a decision for wiser heads than mine to take." "I see," he nodded, and stuck out a hand for me to shake. After a moment's juggling, more to put him off balance than anything, I transferred the glass to my other hand and took it.
Erasmus Denali, Imperial Envoy.
I thought as much, I smiled in return.
You have the look of a diplomat about you.
Whereas you seem quite exceptional for a soldier. Denali sipped his drink and I followed suit, finding it a very pleasant vintage.
Most of them can't wait for the shooting to start.
They're Imperial Guard, I said. They live to fight for the Emperor.
I'm a commissar. I'm supposed to consider the bigger picture.
Which includes avoiding combat? You surprise me.
As I said before, I told him, that's not my decision to make. But if people like you can solve the conflict by negotiation and keep troopers who would have died here alive to fight another enemy another day, and maybe tip the balance in a more important battle, then it seems to me that you're serving the best interests of the Imperium.
And keeping my skin whole into the bargain, of course, which was far more important to me.
Denali looked surprised and a little gratified.
I can see your reputation is far from exaggerated, he said, and I hope I can oblige you, but it may not be easy.
That wasn't what I wanted to hear, you can be sure, but I shrugged and sipped my drink.
As the Emperor wills, I said.
A phrase I'd picked up from Jürgen over the course of our long association. Of course, when he says it, he means every word. From me, it's just the verbal equivalent of a shrug. I've never really bought the idea that His Divine Majesty can spare some attention from the job of preventing the entire galaxy from sliding into damnation to look out for my interests too, or anyone else's for that matter, which is why I'm so diligent about doing it for myself. The difficulty, I take it, being the public support for the Tau in certain quarters.
Exactly, my new friend nodded gloomily. For which you can thank the imbecile over there talking to your colonel.
He indicated Grice with a tilt of his head.
He got so carried away counting his bribes from the likes of him,
another tilt of the head to the far corner of the room,
that he hardly even noticed his planet slipping out from under him.
I turned in the direction he'd indicated. A cadaverous, hawk-nosed individual dressed in unwise scarlet hose and a burgundy tabard was holding forth to a knot of the local aristocracy. Flanking him were a couple of servants in livery who looked about as comfortable as an orc in evening dress. Hired guns, if I'd ever seen them. A scribe hovered next to him, making notes.
One of the rogue traders we've heard so much about, I said.
Denali shrugged.
So he says, but no one here is entirely what they seem, Commissar. You can certainly depend on that.
Well, he was right on the money so far as I was concerned. So I exchanged a few more inconsequential words and resumed circulating. After a few more conversations with local dignitaries, whose names I never quite caught, my glass was in need of replenishment, and I headed towards the table at the far end of the room, where an enticing display of delicacies had been laid out. On the way, I noticed Castine had managed to extricate herself from the governor's presence and was working the room as though she'd been a habitué of high society since she could walk. The air of confidence she now radiated was remarkable, especially set against her earlier nervousness, but the ability to seem calm and in control, whatever the circumstances, is a vital quality in a leader, and for all I knew, she was shamming it as shamelessly as I was. It certainly looked as though she was enjoying herself there, and I gave her a light-hearted salute as our eyes briefly met. She responded with a flashing grin and whirled away towards the dance floor with a couple of aristocratic fops in tow.
It looks like you've lost your date,
a voice said behind me. I turned and found myself falling into the wide blue eyes of the singer I'd been watching before. Uncharacteristically for me, I was momentarily at a loss for words. She was smiling, a plate of finger food in her hand.
She's just a colleague, I said. A fellow officer. Nothing like that between us. Strictly against regulations, for one thing. And anyway, we're not...
She laughed. A warm, smoky chuckle, which warmed me like Amasek, and I realised she was pulling my leg.
I know, she said. No time for romance in the Imperial Guard. It must be grim for you.
We have our duty to the Emperor, I said. For a soldier, that's enough. It's the sort of thing I usually say, and most civilians lap it up. But my beautiful singer was looking at me quizzically.
the ghost of a smile quirking at the corner of her mouth, and I suddenly got the feeling that she could see right through me to the core of deceit and self-interest I normally keep concealed from the world. It was an unnerving sensation. For some, maybe. But I think there's more to you than meets the eye. She picked up a bottle from the nearby table with her free hand and topped up my glass. There's more to everyone than meets the eye, I said, more to deflect the conversation than anything else. She smiled again. That's very astute, Commissar. She extended a hand, slim and cool to the touch, the middle finger ornamented with a large and finely wrought ring of unusual workmanship. Evidently she was extremely successful in her profession, or had at least one wealthy admirer. I would have laid money on both. I kissed it formally, as etiquette demanded, and to my astonishment she giggled. A gentleman as well as an officer. You are full of surprises. Then she surprised me by dropping a curtsy, an imitation of the bovine debutante surrounding us, the light of mischief in her dazzling eyes. I'm Amberly Vale, by the way. I sing a bit. I know, I said. And very well, too. She acknowledged the compliment with a tilt of her head. I bowed formally, entering into the game. Caiaphas Kane, I said, at your service. Currently attached to the Valhallan 597th. Her eyes widened a little as I introduced myself. I've heard of you, she said a little breathlessly. Didn't you fight the gene stealers on Kefir? Well, I had, if you count hanging around drinking recaf, while the artillery unit I was with dropped shells on the biggest concentrations of stealers we could find from kloms away as fighting. I'd been in at the death, so to speak, and emerged with a great deal of the credit, more by luck than good judgment. It was one of the early incidents that had laid the foundations of my undeserved reputation for heroism, but my misadventures since had tended to overshadow what most of the galaxy still regarded as a minor incident on a backwater agri-world. Not entirely alone, I said, slipping easily into the modest hero demeanour I could adopt without thinking. There was an Imperial battle fleet in orbit at the time. And two full divisions of Imperial Guard on planet. She laughed again at my astonished expression. I have relatives in Skanderborg.
Skanderborg is the provincial capital of the smaller of the northern continents. Most of the action in the cleansing of Kefir took place on the southern continent, where the gene-stealer cult was most deeply entrenched, so Skanderborg and its population would have been relatively untouched by the fighting.
You're still talked about back there. I can't think why, I said. I was just doing my job. Of course, Amberly nodded, and again I got the feeling that she wasn't fooled for a moment. You're an Imperial Commissar. Duty before everything, right?
Absolutely, I said. And right now I think it's my duty to ask you to dance.
It was a transparent attempt to change the subject, which I hoped she'd put down to modest embarrassment, and I half expected her to refuse. But she smiled, discarding her plate of half-eaten delicacies, and took my uninjured arm. I'd love to, she said. I've a few minutes before my second set. So we drifted across to the dance floor, and I spent a very pleasant few minutes with her head on my shoulder as we spun around to an old waltz I'd never learned the name of. Castine galloped past a couple of times, a different swain in tow on each occasion, raising an eyebrow in a way which forewarned me of some relentless leg-pulling on our drive back to the compound. But just at that moment, I couldn't have cared less. Eventually, Amberly pulled away with what seemed like reluctance, unless I was succumbing to wishful thinking, and began to return to the stage. I walked with her, chatting to no purpose, intent simply on prolonging a pleasant interlude in what otherwise promised to be a dull evening. And it was thus that I noticed a quiet, vehement altercation between Grice and the hawk-faced rogue trader. "Do you know who that is?" I asked, not really expecting an answer. But it seemed my companion was well-versed in the intricacies of Gravelaxian politics. It came with performing for the aristocracy, I suppose. She nodded, looking surprised. His name's Aurelius, a rogue trader here to deal with the Tau, so he says. The qualification was delivered in precisely the same tone of scepticism as Denali's had been, and for some reason I found myself remembering Devis's cloak and dagger fantasies from our night in the Eagle's Wing. "Why do you say that?" I asked. Amberley shrugged. The Tau have been dealing with the same traders for more than a century. Aurelius arrived from nowhere a month or two ago and tried opening negotiations with them through Grice. It may just be a coincidence, but... She shrugged, her dress slipping across her slim shoulders. "Why now, with the political situation destabilising?" I asked. She nodded. "It does seem a little unusual. Perhaps he's hoping to take advantage of the confusion to strike a better deal," I said. Aurelius turned on his heel as I watched and marched away, trailed by his bodyguards. Grice was pale and sweating, even more than usual, and reached out to pluck a drink from a nearby servitor with a trembling hand. "He's thrown a scare into our illustrious governor at any event." "Has he?" Amberley watched him go. "That seems a little presumptuous, even for a rogue trader." "If that's what he really is," I said without thinking. Those depthless blue eyes turned on me again. "What else would he be?" "An inquisitor," I said, the idea taking firmer root in my head even as I said it. Amberley's eyes widened. "An inquisitor? Here?" Her voice became a little tremulous, as though the enormity of the idea were too huge to grasp. "What makes you think that?" The urge to impress her was almost irresistible, I have to confess. And if you could only know how bewitching she was, I know you'd have felt the same. So I looked my most commissarial. "All I can say," I told her, lowering my voice for dramatic effect, "is that I've heard from a reliable military source," which sounded a lot better than "from a drunken idiot, I'm sure you'll agree," "that there are Inquisition agents active on Gravellax." "Surely not," she shook her head, blonde tresses flying in confusion. "And even if there were, why would you suspect Aurelius?" "Well, just look at him," I said. "Everyone knows that undercover inquisitors disguise themselves as rogue traders most of the time."
"It is indeed regrettable that this predilection has become so widely known. Personally, I blame popular fiction for perpetuating the stereotype, although it has to be said that some inquisitors are simply woefully lacking in imagination when required to adopt a disguise."
"It's by far the easiest way of travelling incognito with the rabble of hangers-on they all seem to attract." "You could be right," she said with a delicate shiver. "But it's no concern of ours." "Well, I couldn't agree more, of course, but that's not what my heroic reputation leads people to expect of me. So I put on my best dutiful expression and said, 'The security of the Imperium is the concern of all His Majesty's loyal servants.' Well, that's true too, and it lets me out, but no one needs to know that." Amberley nodded somberly and trotted back to the stage. And I watched her go, cursing myself for an idiot for puncturing the mood. As you'll no doubt appreciate, the rest of the evening promised to be anticlimactic, so I drifted back to the food and drink. Our rations back at the compound were adequate enough, but I wasn't going to pass up the opportunity to savour a few delicacies while they were there for the taking. And it was as good a vantage point as any to enjoy Amberley's performance from. It was also, as I'd learned from uncountable similar affairs, the best spot from which to cull gossip, since everyone gravitated there sooner or later. Thus it was that I made the acquaintance of Aurelius, without the faintest presentiment of the trouble that innocent conversation would lead to. If anything, I suppose, it was the sling that was to blame. It had seemed a good idea at the time, but now I came to fill a plate, the damn thing got in the way, preventing me from reaching out for the palavine pastries perched on the opposite side of the table. If I transferred the plate to my left hand, I was turned awkwardly. My centre of mass shifted, so I still couldn't reach. I was trying to work out a way of getting to them when a thin arm reached across to pick up the dish. "Allow me." The voice was dry and cultured. I transferred a couple of the delicacies to my plate and found myself addressing the man I'd almost convinced myself was an inquisitorial agent. It was ridiculous, of course, but still. "Thank you, Sir Aurelius," I said. "You're most kind." "Have we met?" His eyes were shadowed. The irises were almost black and had an unnerving, piercing quality that increased his resemblance to a bird of prey. "Your reputation precedes you," I said blandly, letting him make of that what he would. I don't mind admitting I was less relaxed than I tried to look. If he really was an inquisitor, there was a good chance he was a psyker too, and might know me for what I was. But I'd encountered mind readers before, and knew they weren't as formidable as most people thought. Most of them can only read surface thoughts, and I was so long practiced at dissembling that I did so without any conscious awareness of the fact.
I'm sure it does.
He was an old hand at this game too, I realised. An essential skill, whether his profession was as it appeared, or as I had surmised. You seem to have the ear of His Excellency, I said, and the first momentary flicker of emotion appeared on his face. I got in under his guard, it seemed.
I have both. Unfortunately, His Excellency appears to lack anything between them.
He took one of the pastries for himself.
He's paralysed with indecision.
Indecision about what? I asked ingenuously.
Where his best interests lie, and those of his people, of course.
Aurelius bit into the delicacy as though it were Grice's neck.
Unless he starts showing some leadership, this world will go down in blood and burning, but he sits and vacillates and hopes it will all go away.
Then let's hope he comes to his senses soon, I said. The keen eyes impaled me again.
Indeed. His voice was level. For all our sakes.
He smiled then, without warmth.
The Emperor be with you, Commissar Kane.
My surprise must have shown on my face, because the smile widened a fraction.
Your reputation precedes you too.
And then he was gone, leaving me curiously troubled. I didn't have long to dwell on my unease, though, because the flunky who'd announced our arrival was back, looking a little flustered. He'd called out a number of names since Castine and I had made our entrance, but it was clear that this time he expected to be listened to. He pounded a staff on the polished wooden floor, and the babble of voices gradually diminished. Amberley's trailed away in mid-chorus, which was a real shame. The flunky's chest inflated with self-importance.
Your Excellency, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, Oran Shui Sasai, Ambassador of the Tau.
And for the first time since arriving on Gravelax, I was face to face with the enemy.